And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so please keep that pencil and recycled paper handy. Now let's get right on into an Earth First little special deal here. Instead of our commentary that we normally have at the beginning of the second half of the recorded portion of the show, we're going to go to the David Brower Memorial, where Uncle Dennis had a chance to talk with several people, and one of those people was Julia Butterfly Hill. I was asking her what was going on up at Luna. Talking with Julia Butterfly Hill at the David Brower Memorial. Listen to your talk today. You spoke quite eloquently about how you felt about what's happened to Luna in recent days. Wondered if you had any words for Earth First Radio about what's happening next. What's going on with Luna?
Well, the first thing that's important for people to remember is something I've tried my best all along to remind people, that Luna has always been a lot more than just about one tree or one person. That it's about what's happening to our forests and what's happening in our world. And so Luna being cut by someone in spite and anger is proof of what's going on out there. So what's next for Luna is we're trying to see if we can help save her. We're doing our best, and then we're going to leave the rest up to Creator and Luna to decide if Luna stands or falls. She's very susceptible to winds, so it's going to be the most difficult part.
And being a ridge tree, this is very critical.
Yeah, absolutely. But more than anything, what's next is that we're really trying hard. I really believe in my heart that Luna was able to take this cut and willing to take this cut so that it might motivate even more people to remember that there's trees falling every day out there. But because people aren't hearing about it, because the mainstream press is not doing their job to cover it, I almost feel like Luna was willing to be cut in order to get that back out there into people's consciousness that the forests still need people's help.
Well, thank you very much. I know you have to go.
Thank you.
Julia Butterfly Hill on Earth First Radio.
Thank you so much. Thanks for doing what you're doing.
You're welcome. For Earth First Radio, this is Uncle Dennis. I want to let folks know that there will be a special for radio production on the David Brower Memorial. For those of you here in Santa Cruz or listening on the internet, that 21-minute special will be aired right after the local news here on Earth First Radio in Santa Cruz. For those of you who are on the internet, the David Brower Memorial special will be available as an MP3 file at www.radioforall.net. And let's get back into the news here. A federal judge has ordered the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to make a decision on whether to propose federal listing of the western yellow-billed cuckoo as an endangered species. The cuckoo has declined dramatically as western riparian areas have been destroyed by dams, water diversions, logging, cattle grazing, road construction, and just plain old sprawl. It is now essentially extinct in Alaska, British Columbia, Washington, and Oregon. There are a few small isolated populations that remain in California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Sonora, Mexico. Individual birds are still occasionally seen in Nevada, Utah, Idaho, Wyoming, Montana, and western Colorado. Although the Fish and Wildlife Service admits that cuckoos have declined precipitously west of the Continental Divide, and it possesses genetic studies showing that the western population diverged from the eastern population between 400 and 460 thousand years ago, it has delayed protecting it. The service alternately claims that western cuckoos may not constitute a biological population, and that the extinction of cuckoos from all states and provinces west of the Continental Divide is, quote, not significant. Still at issue in the suit is the status of the cuckoo in the eastern United States, Canada, and Mexico. It has also declined there, but not to the same level as in the west. In addition to the western subspecies, the species as a whole should be listed to stem eastern declines before they reach critical levels. If you want more information, you can go to www.biologicaldiversity.org/swcbd. Once again, that's www.biologicaldiversity.org/swcbd. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has announced its final decision to designate about 9 miles of rivers, streams, and estuaries in Southern California as critical habitat for the endangered southern population of the tidewater goby, a small fish native only to California. About 60% of this habitat occurs on the Camp Pendleton Marine Corps base, where there is already a natural resource management plan in place to protect the fish. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service does not expect the designation to affect ongoing military training on the base. The Tidewater Goby was listed as endangered in 1994, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service did not designate critical habitat for the goby at that time. The announcement comes in response to a U.S. District Court order to determine critical habitat in response to a lawsuit filed by the Natural Resources Defense Council. The Tidewater Goby is a 2-inch long grayish-brown fish found in the coastal saltwater lagoons and sometimes in freshwater from Del Norte County south to San Diego County. It has adapted to coastal lagoons and the uppermost brackish zone of larger estuaries, though it often moves into freshwater habitat. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service determined that only the southern populations of the fish, now found in just 8 of 13 known historic locations, qualified for critical habitat designation. Populations north of Orange County are not endangered, the agency said. In addition to being the most genetically distinct population of this species, the Tidewater Gobies in Southern California also appear to be the most endangered, said Ken Berg, field supervisor of the Carlsbad Fish and Wildlife Office. They have disappeared from lagoons and estuaries along half of the scenic Southern California coastline. And a federal judge has ruled that the U.S. Forest Service cannot withhold information from the public concerning the status of goshawks in the Kaibab National Forest and the Grand Canyon National Park. The Forest Service has continually relied on unpublished research to assert that goshawk populations are stable and more impacted by prey population cycles than logging, but it has refused to provide any of this information to the public, claiming the research is exempt from the U.S. Freedom of Information Act. The federal judge has upheld the strict requirement of the act, however, and ordered the agency to provide all but the most biologically sensitive information to the Southwest Center for Biological Diversity. And another federal judge has ordered a suit brought by the Greenpeace Foundation, the Center for Biological Diversity, and the Sea Turtle Restoration to protect the Hawaiian monk seals from competition with and killing by commercial fisheries. The lobster fishery will be closed until a plan is approved to protect the seals. A future order will determine if and when the bottom fish fishery will be closed or modified. The Hawaiian monk seal is one of the world's most endangered marine mammals. It has declined to about 1,300 individuals, primarily found in the northwestern Hawaiian islands, where it must compete for food with an aggressive commercial lobster fishery. During the 1990s, the largest colony on French frigate Soles suffered a 55% decline because juvenile seals are starving to death, even as the lobster fishery is permitted to capture hundreds of thousands of spiny and slipper lobsters from the monk seals, formerly designated critical habitat, each year. Ironically, the fishing pressure is so intense that the industry is putting itself out of business. Several temporary closures of fishery have failed to revive the lobster population. The bottom fish fishery kills seals by accidentally hooking them and by feeding them unwanted fish containing Ciguatera toxin. It operates without environmental observers, despite evidence that monk seals have been bludgeoned to death by bottom fish fishermen or fisherwomen. Who knows? And a plan clears a path for logging. This story by Michael Milstein of the Oregonian. New guidelines for protecting rare species that depend on old-growth forests will open the way for more timber cutting in the Northwest. The plan released recently drops more than 60 species from the list of plants, animals, and other forest life that biologists must look for before logging can begin. Some of the species, such as a tiny mushroom that turns out to live mainly in Wyoming, probably never should have been on the list, which was compiled as part of a 1994 Northwest Forest Plan, sweeping attempt by the Clinton administration to balance logging with species protection. Others, such as a slug known as the Papaloo's tail dropper, have proved to be more common than forest officials first thought. Biologists originally lumped such species into a group of more than 400 organisms thought to live only in the Northwest old-growth forests. Federal officials said their shortened list of about 340 species should streamline long and costly surveys for slugs, fungi, lichen, moss, and other organisms that have often slowed logging promised under the 1994 Forest Plan. We included some of these species because we didn't know much about them, said Chris Strebig of the U.S. Bureau of Land Management. Now we're fine-tuning based on new information to make sure we protect both tenets of the Northwest Forest Plan to protect species and provide reasonable timber harvest. Biologists would also be able to drop additional species from scrutiny if research shows that logging would not threaten the organisms. The Secretaries of Interior and Agriculture are expected to put the new strategy into effect in January. But conservation groups said they may challenge the action in federal court because it undermines the Northwest Forest Plan's goal of protecting the integrity of old-growth forests and life forms that inhabit them. Quote, they're basically making it easier to log old growth, said Doug Hagen of the Oregon Natural Resources Council. Quote, we may know more about these species, but we still have enough uncertainty to remain cautious. I don't think we know enough to start dropping species from the list left and right. And thousands of mink will be saved in the United Kingdom from slaughter now that Britain has become the first country in the world to ban raising animals for their pelts. After years of lobbying, the fur farming prohibition bill became law last week and takes effect in January of 2003. Now groups like People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals are taking their anti-fur campaign overseas. PETA's effort to pass the British bill included persuading five politicians to cram themselves into a tiny wire mesh cage holding a banner reading ban fur farming. The group released a video narrated by designer Stella McCartney, which showed animals on fur farms suffering untreated wounds and slow deaths. A poll commissioned last year by the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals showed that 74% of British people supported a ban on fur farming and 86% said they did not want to wear real fur. PETA is counting on other European countries to follow Britain's lead, and another bill aimed at protecting wildlife is expected to become law soon. The Countryside and Rights of Way Bill receives final consideration this week after several amendments in the United Kingdom's House of Commons and House of Lords. The bill secures the conservation and restoration of United Kingdom's most threatened species and habitats. And President Bill Clinton has recently signed legislation conferring national park status on 38,000 acres of land in Colorado's San Luis Valley. The new Great Sand Dunes National Park, where 700-foot-high sand dunes rise against a backdrop of snow-capped mountains, has been administered as a national monument since 1932. The legislation last week also establishes the Great Sand Dunes Preserve adjacent to the national park through a land transfer with the U.S. Forest Service. The preserve, which will be managed by the National Park Service, will remain open to hunters, however. The legislation signed this week will protect dune plants, including Indian rice grass, scurf pea, and prairie sunflower. It will also provide protection for a variety of animals such as golden eagles, red-tailed hawks, mountain bluebirds, kangaroo rats, ground squirrels, and mule deer. The protection will extend to rare archaeological sites that tell of nomadic hunters dating back to 11,000 years and the largest known stand of ponderosa pine trees in the United States bearing ancient tribal markings. Congress appropriated $8.5 million to acquire the lands to establish the new Great Dunes National Park. And the aerial fumigation program that has grown out of the United States government's so-called war on drugs is endangering the fragile ecosystems and indigenous cultures of the Colombian Amazon Basin, a coalition of groups have warned. The fumigation program, which U.S. finances as part of the $1.3 billion Colombian aid package approved last summer, is designed to eradicate coca and other plants used to manufacture illicit drugs. But critics say the program indiscriminately wipes out legitimate substances such as subsistence crops, such as natural plants, and also kills birds, mammals, and aquatic life. The chemicals are applied by aircraft and frequently fall on Colombia's indigenous peoples, subjecting them to a variety of health afflictions, critics add. Quote, this spraying campaign is equivalent to the Agent Orange devastation of Vietnam, a disturbance the wildlife and natural ecosystems have never recovered from, unquote, said Dr. David Olson, director of the World Wildlife Fund's Conservation Science Program. And it is occurring on the watch of the current Congress and executive administration and is supported by your taxpayer dollars. Though carried out by Colombian police and military authorities, the aerial fumigation program utilizes U.S. government aircraft fuel, escort helicopters, and private military contractors, read mercenaries. The herbicide approved for the program, glyphosate, is manufactured in the U.S.-based Monsanto Corporation and is commonly referred to by the trade name Roundup. Glyphosate is a non-selective herbicide, meaning that any plant exposed to a sufficient amount of the chemical will be killed. The chemical has been sprayed over tens of thousands of acres in Colombia since the early 1990s, but the eradication program has done little to curtail the supply of cocaine that comes into the U.S. every year. Appeals to stop the fumigation policy have been made to President Bill Clinton, who has sent a letter to representatives, nearly three dozen environmental, human rights, and public policy groups. The letter urges Clinton to cancel the fumigation program, saying its long-term ecological effects could be severe. If you want more information on the campaign, you can go to www.usfumigation.org. That's usfumigation.org. Check out that website. And from Uqualit, Nunavut, Canada, we read that the removal of hunting limits on narwhal whales has led to Canada's northern Inuit people catching an unprecedented number of the single-tusked marine mammals. Established in April of 1999, Nunavut is Canada's newest territory and accounts for 1.9 million square kilometers, nearly one-fifth the size of Canada. Recently has been asserting its autonomy and is in the process of creating a new wildlife law. The narwhal's tusks and matak or blubber are commercially valuable. Matak not consumed by the community can be sold, while the animal's tusks are prized by collectors and carvers. Canadian Department of Fisheries and Oceans biologists warn that overhunting could cause narwhal populations to decline in the long term, but biologists and hunters disagree on the narwhal's population and how often the narwhal reproduce. Biologists say narwhals calve only once every 3 years, while hunters say they see narwhal with two young calves of different ages. And after years of debate, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service said recently that it would reintroduce grizzly bears into the Bitterroot Mountains of western Montana and central Idaho beginning in a couple of years. The reintroduced bears would have less protection than other grizzlies in the wild, which are listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. Build a partnership between forest industry groups and environmentalists. The plan is to establish a 15-minute member citizen advisory committee for the reintroduction project. But Idaho Governor Dirk Kempthorne and Idaho Senators Mike Crapo remain adamantly opposed to the whole reintroduction plan, and the feds acknowledge that the next administration and Congress may not fund it. Governor Kempthorne said he may go to court to block the reintroduction of massive flesh-eating carnivores into that state. And a large sugar pine in the Tiller Ranger District of the Umpqua National Forest in Oregon has been girdled over the last weekend. That means that the bark has been cut all the way around the tree, which can kill the tree by cutting off its food supply from the roots. This was a famous tree thought to be the tallest sugar pine tree in the world. It was 265, or still is, I guess, 265 feet tall and 7.5 feet in diameter. Law enforcement officials are investigating. And in a move that has surprised conservationists, the Colorado Wildlife Commission has voted 5-3 to prohibit all sport hunting of black-tailed prairie dogs east of the Continental Divide in Colorado. The Colorado Wildlife Commission made it clear that the decision was made in part to, quote, help convince the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that there is not a declare the black-tailed prairie dog a threatened species under federal law. The Colorado Wildlife Commission ruling still allows private landowners and state allotment permittees to shoot prairie dogs that damage crops or grazing land. The shooting of other species of prairie dogs, including gunnisons, Richardsons, and whitetails, is not affected by the CWC decision. The state has also started a compensation program to pay landowners who allow black-tailed prairie dogs on their prairie dog activists are still urging the commission to act to curtail the poisoning of prairie dogs and the bulldozing of their habitat, which biologists say account for far more black-tailed prairie dogs than shooting in the rapidly declining urban and suburban colonies along the Front Range. If you'd like to send a comment to the Colorado Wildlife Commission, you can send it to wildlife.com with two M's at state.co.us. That's wildlife.com at state.co.us, and that com is spelled with two M's. And in rather disturbing news, in an article written by Jane George of the National Post, animals in the Arctic are showing deformities. According to a survey of hunters, animals in the eastern Arctic are showing some troubling abnormalities, says a recent survey of hunters and elders of four Nunavut communities. Quote, at one time I have hunted a seal in the summer and everything about the seal was unhealthy, unquote, said Kwali Kununlisi of Quirksgarkwak, I can't read that name, on the east coast of Baffin Island. Internal organs were swollen. I have seen seals with patches of skin missing and the skin had holes in them. The World Wildlife Fund and Baffin Island's Kwiktaqwalluk Wildlife Board did this survey because of the many undocumented reports of deformities in animals. A total of 16 hunters and 15 elders from the communities of Kwiktaqwalluk, Kimmerut, Hall Beach, and Arctic Bay, a combined hunting experience of about 800 years, participated in the survey. I have been going out on the land all my life. I have been hunting ever since I was able, said Kunu Uyukulu from Arctic Bay. Interviewers gathered the participants' traditional knowledge on animal health and then tried to quantify this information more or less successfully. Due to the anecdotal nature of the evidence, the survey does not attempt to chart the exact frequency of abnormalities according to species or locations, but it is clear that hunters and elders from every community are seeing striking abnormalities in at least one of the species they harvest regularly, whether it be seal, walrus, beluga whale, narwhal whale, or polar bears. The abnormalities involve changes in the physical condition of the animals. Many animals, particularly caribou, seal, and polar bears, are reported to be skinny. Parasites were seen in caribou, seals, and fish, and the color of meat and fat in walrus, seal, and polar bear was said to be different than it used to be. Perhaps one of the most interesting observations that was made in seal, walrus, and narwhal was the presence of roundworms in the skin, says a draft version of the report. These were described as looking like burns or a circular bit of skin that was removed. Further investigation into this condition is warranted. A similar abnormality was found on a walrus in Arctic Bay in March of this year. That one was analyzed and determined to be caused by a strain of bacteria that is also responsible for flesh-eating disease. Hunters also told about butchering walnuts that had fluid or pus between the meat and fat. They had also found a seal with pus-filled white spots on its liver, seals with kidney stones, seals with fur missing, and some with large heads. Almost half of the participants said they see more abnormalities these days than before, and they proposed several theories on why these abnormalities may be more frequent now. Many suggested modern technology and contaminants are harming the animals, while others pointed to climate change, ozone depletion, and overpopulation as possible culprits. I have heard of these abnormalities in the past. I think these marine mammals are more affected today than in the past as I hear more hunters talking about them. I think there is the deterioration of our environment, said David Kunaliusi from Kiktarkujak. I can't pronounce that name. Those who hunt polar bear are said tranquilizing and tagging bears, a common strategy used by wildlife biologists, was harming the bears. The ones that have been tranquilized don't taste good. They are skinny, they become sick, and they're not scared at all. I have definitely noticed a change, not all of them, but the ones with the tags are very skinny now. We eat the meat, but it doesn't taste good anymore. I didn't make that up. I'm telling you the way it is, said Isaac Shuyuk from Arctic Bay. The survey report urges more monitoring because, quote, Inuit people consume these animals daily, unquote. To improve monitoring, the report recommends educating Inuits about abnormalities and the various species that can be affected. And unfortunately, that's about all the time we have for news right now on Earth First Radio. To get news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, send us email at cruzief@cruzio.com. That's C-R-U-Z-E-F at C-R-U-Z-I-O.com. cruzief@cruzio. Or you can send letters to Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Once again, that address is Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And be sure to send those announcements in at least 3 weeks in advance. If you want more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address is P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. Once again, that's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. And the first issue is free. You can listen to Earth First Radio live on your computer every Thursday evening at 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Go to www.microradio.net/FRSC and listen in. There's lots of great shows on Free Radio Santa Cruz anytime, and you can always find Earth First Radio archive shows on the World Wide Web at www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. The software you need to play the MP3 files is free on the website if you don't already have it. Earth First Radio is on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Please ask your local station to rebroadcast Earth First Radio. Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, and portions of this newscast were prepared with the help of our intern, Stefan. Our theme music was written and performed by Gerald Cherney off the CD Keep It Wild. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening to Earth First Radio, and now we're going to listen to the new Robert Hoyt CD called Mind's Eye. The tune's called Jack Road.
I wake and sit up in the bright bright sunshine. Things are just as crazy as they seem. I see the old man's beard up in the lodgepole pine, and I realize that it is not a dream. Summers in the mountains of central Idaho, it's hot as hell one day, next day it snows. The nights are short, the days are long and slow, but the night work gets done. What happens now, no one knows. So we huddle around our fire out on the Jack Road. It's getting late in the century, awaiting our fate out on the Jack Road. A road that was never meant to be. My helicopter view, but they'll head this way for their plastic and God's guns and pepper spray. Cut us out with big machines and power tools, dressed in their silly uniforms, looking just like fools. So we huddle around our fire out on the Jack Road. It's getting late in the century, awaiting our fate out on the Jack Road. Perhaps they'll come next week, perhaps tomorrow is the day. We fight the boredom, but we stay. When they arrive, right here, if we can hold out till October, we'll have held them off a year. So we huddle around our fire out on the